This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, engaging brains and fascinating characters in sport. Today's guest has been instrumental to some of Britain's biggest sporting successes over the past decade or so, but few outside of his sport will have heard of him. Rod Ellingworth spotted, nourished and coached talents who went on to win 13 world titles, 5 Olympic golds, 51 victories at the sport's most difficult races, the Grand Tours, and 1 Tour de France. And that's on top of the other 5 Tour de France victories he's had a hand in with his role as coach at Team Sky. For Ellingworth, though, the real passion of his life hasn't been at the elite end of cycling, but at youth development. Now, if you're vaguely aware of, but think the success of British cyclists in recent years has come easily, then you haven't yet heard Rod's story. The dedication, commitment, devotion to learning and to constantly making things better are an example to any of us as to how to go about doing a job properly. And listening to him, it's not so much a surprise that he achieved the results that he did. It would have been more of a surprise if he hadn't. His was a long, and often still is, fairly thankless slog. This is how you make a champion. This is When Orla Met Rod Ellingworth. So Rod, we're sitting in your beautiful home in the Peak District a few months only after Geraint Thomas won the biggest bike race in the world. And that means that you've taken him from a boy, really, a teenager, and coached him all the way through to winning the Tour de France. Have you had a bit of time to look back on that journey and your whole part of it?
It doesn't seem like yesterday, actually, since he won the race. So no, I haven't really stopped. I think that's the problem with this world, really. You never really stop, you know, and the moment you do, you sort of get left behind. So you're constantly, you know, striving forward. But I mean, it's definitely felt a different win to any of the others. And it sort of meant quite a lot, I think, personally, for myself and Dave B, in a way. You know, it's sort of, you know, we've been around Geraint that long. So yeah, certainly we have thought about it, and we have had a little chat every now and again. So yeah, it's been good, yeah.
Dave B, so Dave Brailsford, as you say, you've sort of known his entire makeup, I guess, for such a long time. And I know how much it meant to you. I saw you during the Tour de France and almost the realisation that he was going to win it. Why was it so special? You say it's more special maybe than any of the other wins. Why is that?
I think just, you know, when you know somebody since they were a kid, you know, and you've been through all the ups and downs of their lives. And it just seems like he was one of our original guys, if you like. Certainly in my coaching career, was, you know, Geraint was one of the first group. He came in at the end of the first year of the academy starting. So, you know, he's really been part of my life, every bit of the way that I've gone through. And when I look back now, since sort of 2004 and what we've done, it's, you know, it's been a lot of work, been travelled all around, you know, we've done a lot of things, and Geraint's been sort of one of them guys in that the whole time. I think also what makes it a little bit more unique, there's very few of them who are on Team Sky and at that sort of level, you know. So I think that's what's made it special, really. You know, he's still there. We're still together working in that way. I mean, I don't actually coach Geraint now. You know, Tim Kerrison actually does the day-to-day coaching with him, but I'm very involved in all the big events that he does, you know. So, yeah, so that's what, it's just the length of time. It's been a long time, really.
So you mentioned that whole group of guys. So let's take the whole story back to the beginning then. You were GB coach, Great Britain cycling coach, and you started this under 23 cycling academy, which is originally based in Manchester. Then you took this group of lads over to Tuscany and trained them all there. And amongst those was also Mark Cavendish, who went on to become world champion, the most successful sprinter at the Tour de France. I mean, quite a calibre of riders that you selected back then. How did you pick that talent? How did that all get off the ground?
Yeah, I mean, that first year was quite difficult because I was a bit more like that. We've got to work on the system and the program first. And I remember sort of saying, we'll select some riders. I don't really know them that well. You know, I'd only been back in the UK from racing in France myself only a couple of years. And, you know, we're just sort of getting to grips a little bit with where the British sort of scene was again. But you could see that some of the guys were talented, but you never knew where they were going to go. So I really concentrated on how were we going to work? What was our sort of program? How hard were we going to push them? And I looked at quite a lot of different systems from, you know, old historic sort of sporting worlds of like the AIS in Australia. I even looked at sort of, you know, how the Russians used to do it. I was intrigued. In 1989, I went out to Moscow to the Junior Worlds when I was only 16. And I saw there all the Russian gymnasts and the Russian cyclists in their school as it was. And I just thought it looked brutal, you know, and just really, that was proper hardcore. And you know, I think now we learn quite a lot of bad things going off, but there was something in the way about some of the structure and discipline and everything else. So it was all sort of all these things that I was thinking about. If we can get that right and give them a good vehicle to be in where they can grow, then, you know, who knows what could happen. So I didn't know what was going to happen. Just went with it, you know, and just went with what was in my gut, what I was thinking about.
So that structure and discipline, did that strike you as a 16-year-old, or was that something that you thought about later?
No, that was evident there and then, yeah. Yeah, it really was, yeah. I mean, even back then as a kid, I was always, the army, the forces always interested me, and like the fire brigade always interested me. I sort of always wanted to be a fireman when I was a kid. So all that, you know, it's all about discipline and structure and being able to put yourself in a situation and deal with a situation there and then. And I quite like that. That's how I always saw my own cycling in a way. It was, you're in a situation, now what do you do? What's next, you know? So it's about a lot of it was about teaching the kids, or them young lads, get to a T-junction, what do you do? It's not about me telling them where to go. It was about giving them the power to make the right decisions, you know? So, because I think then race moments, it's split seconds and you've got to do it right.
So that's funny, because I interviewed Mark Cavendish for the first series of this podcast, and he said about the army and how that always appealed to him. And if he hadn't been a cyclist, he would have maybe joined up and been a soldier. There's a running theme there.
Oh dear. Yeah. I mean, well, I think, you know, obviously the academy really worked for Mark. It really, you know, and I think he still holds a lot of them sort of standards and procedures at heart, really. Where some of the guys it didn't work for, and I think for Geraint it was a bit of a challenge. It wasn't, you know, he didn't quite see it the same. He didn't need that parental maybe guidance as maybe Mark needed at the time. He was a bit more of his own sort of person and knew exactly what he wanted to do. I could see that really early with Geraint, you know. And it didn't take him long before he was moving on and pushing on to go further, you know. So I think everybody sees it differently, but certainly for Mark, it worked because of that discipline and structure. And that's what he identified with really, really quickly, you know.
Because you took them off to this beautiful base, or where you were based was absolutely stunning in Italy. And I guess on paper, it looked like the guys were living the dream. They're out riding their bikes every day, you know, they're living with their mates, they're having fun. But you did instill quite a bit of discipline in them. And, you know, there was essay writing and everything involved in that, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was all sorts. Yeah, I used to throw anything at them, really. But I mean, for me, it was all just about them feeling like they were clocking in the morning and then they were clocking out at night. So, you know, it was
killing off that youthful dream.
Well, you know, it's just, you know, at the end of the day, they were 18 and it was about taking responsibility, you know. And so it was one about getting them to really think about what can they achieve in life and what's their own personal ambitions, and going, if you really mean it, what does it take? But then there was also this thing of, okay, that we will follow you, we'll believe you, but there's a payoff to that. And this is what you have to do in return. And that was eventually to bring back Olympic medals as a performance, you know. But along the way, behave yourself, keep yourself on track, you know. And I think a lot of people, it's interesting, I hear now a lot of people have got it wrong how I used to discipline them. They think I just used to shout and bawl at them and be like, you know, like this, line up and do 100 press-ups or whatever. It wasn't that at all. You know, it was all, you know, they wrote their own rules. They wrote their own consequences. They even signed that. So when somebody was late or somebody didn't communicate how they should do or whatever, you know, I disciplined them along their rules. It wasn't, I never shouted at them or, perhaps did, yeah, once or twice, but not, you know, not in a abusive way or whatever, you know. It was just sort of it was all to encourage them, and it was all about their own sort of careers, you know. And I'll just say to them, you've let yourself down, you've really disappointed me and the team, you know. And you say things like that to people, they really take it to heart, you know.
The worst thing ever, isn't it? You've let yourself down.
Yeah.
What kind of discipline then are we talking about? You say that they bought into it themselves. Yeah. They've essentially wrote their own contract, I guess, amongst themselves. Yeah. So what were the rules and what were the repercussions if they broke them?
Well, I mean, a lot of it for me was around timekeeping and being in the right place at the right time, because, you know, it is a team sport, and it's a team sport with a certain dynamic of traveling. And, you know, there's so much traveling. There's so many, you know, I think like the Giro this year, we had like 18 different hotels, and, you know, there's all that. You're reliant on being in the vehicle at the right time to get to the start for the right time. And, you know, it's difficult when you're traveling around and you've got traffic to all them, you know, they're all the little detailed things, but you put it all together. Timekeeping is a big one. So if somebody is waiting and you're hanging around 15, 20 minutes, you could be late, or it puts stress on your teammates and so forth. So, you know, that was one where I worked a lot on it, you know, even to the point where I just leave them, you know, I would just leave them. I just drove off without them. Or one of the stories was poor Swifty. I felt really bad.
It was Ben Swifty.
Yeah. I felt really bad afterwards. We were in Moscow doing a World Cup, and the bus was leaving to go to the velodrome, and Swifty wasn't there. So I just left him.
And he was at the hotel.
Yeah. Anyway, he turned up about, so I knew there's buses leaving every sort of 45 minutes or something to get to the velodrome. And so I knew he'd get a bus, you know. Anyway, he turned up in a white old flap, you know, sort of late to get there. And he knew straight away, and he came up, and I sort of, you know, let him know that he let himself down and the consequences of that and his teammates and everything else. And he felt pretty bad. I realised the next day was his 18th birthday. Oh. I know, he told me. I didn't even know. So I was like, oh, sorry, Swifty.
Welcome to adulthood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Oh, unlucky. So it was little things like that. But, you know, I did that as an example, was, you know, discipline like that. Yeah.
I mean, that kind of approach to teaching a group of young guys does sound, I mean, it sounds quite sophisticated. It sounds quite grown up, and maybe we'd be more used to it these days, but we're talking a number of years ago now. And also, you were only a couple of years older than all of these guys at the time. Seems like you did you always have a wise head on your shoulders? How did you know that that was the way to get the best out of them?
I don't know. I just enjoyed, you know, really thinking about how do you take a young group of guys, you know, and it was about getting them to believe in what they were doing and feel proud to work hard. You know, I really worked a lot on being proud to put the British national jersey on your back. So, you know, I looked at a lot about like England rugby and the Lions and all that sort of, you know, how they used to develop and make people really feel proud to get a cap and to move on. And so I worked a lot on that sort of stuff, you know, but it was all about them. It was all about how do they work as a team. And so, you know, all the discipline things were, you know, if they don't communicate to each other, right, you know. So for instance, if you were meant, like every morning they had to be at the track by 7:30 to meet me. But, you know, if they got a problem because they punched it on the way in, or they just got up late, as an example, all they had to do was ring me. So that would be the issue. I'd say, you ring me, then there's not a problem because you're letting me know and so forth. We can all be late, you know, we can all oversleep, can't we, if they're knackered from training or whatever. Or even the other big one is, you know, is trying to get them not to lie to you. So if you've been out on a bender all night, that's why we put them in Fallowfield. We put them in Fallowfield. They literally had to descend the stairs. They were out with all the other students in Manchester, you know.
This is before you moved to Italy,
yeah,
or
yeah,
obvious
this is when
to Manchester.
We first moved to Manchester. Yeah, yeah. You know, they were within, you know, a few minutes of pubs and nightclubs and all sorts.
So you deliberately put them right in Temptation Square.
Yeah, because the young lads, they need to go out. They need to go meet people and do things and, you know, just do the normal lads thing. But they've also got to be at the track by 7:30 every morning. So it was sort of like, if you do go out on a bender, you've had a few drinks and you can't make it, I'll be more lenient if you ring and say, listen, sorry, I went out last night, you know. Because at the end of the day, they'll all crack at some stage. They'll all need some sort of release or whatever. So it was all about them just being honest with me, you know. And if they were honest, then I'm absolutely fine. We'll work with that then. Because it would mean then they'd miss training session. I'll be like, shame, because your teammates are moving on and you're at home because you can't train. So you sort of put it on them a different way, make them feel a bit guilty for what they've done, but I would never stop them from going out. This is where I think a lot of people got it wrong. They thought I was this, you're never allowed out, you know. It's like, God, you know, you want the lads to enjoy themselves. It's like, so there's loads of examples like that.
How did you choose then this group who went on to win? Have you ever counted up actually how many titles they've won between them?
I saw some during the tour, somebody tweeted, not I don't do that Twitter or anything, but somebody sent me
That
a
Twitter.
picture and said, oh look, these are all from that Manchester house. But I can't remember exactly how it was, but I was looking at it thinking, okay, yeah, it's quite good,
I saw that tweet actually. I should have looked at it again before coming. But I mean, we're talking multiple world titles, multiple Olympic titles, Tour de France as well. What was the criteria for selecting? Because if anybody's listening to
Well,
this and thinking about nurturing talent, is it physical ability? Is it mental ability?
Well, it was everything. So I did a matrix of, typical of British cycling, and we love doing matrix and sort of trying to rule out some of the unknowns, you know. So we made this matrix, and it definitely guides it. It definitely gives a good guide, and so it was sort of things like, physically, where are they out of 10, say? Are they physically really talented? What, technically, tactically, mentally, what's their attitude? So I had this list of things, and I can't remember exactly how many numbers, but I may have had like 15 riders who I'd got a look on, and I scored them all. And it interestingly enough, the of that first group, the two who came out on top was Ed Clancy and Mark Cavendish, and that was even before they joined us. So that was just on. So as an example, Ed Clancy would have scored super, super high from a physical point of view, but tactically, technically, and everything, he was quite low.
And he's now World Olympic champion
Olympic,
several
yeah,
times
several
already.
times, yeah. But commitment to work, I think that was one of them. Attitude, all them sort of things were quite high for Ed. For Mark, it was different story, but he still scored. I think Ed came out like 1 point higher than Cav, actually. But he came out, Cav came out pretty good because race tactics, and so I weighted it as well. So things that I thought were really important, I weighted higher than other things, obviously. And for me, technical, tactical, physical, they were the big things really, and then all the other things came underneath. So this is what gave me a basis of, okay, now I shall take them to interview. So I did a proper interview process with them as well.
So what did that consist of?
Well, just so I think if I remember right, it was me and John Herity, and I can't remember. I don't know whether it was Doug Daly or somebody who was in the interviews at first. So basically, just getting them in to sort of, tell me why you want to do this. What's your ambition? Where do you want to go? What? Where are the gaps? What do you need to do? Do you think this could work? And then I remember one of the questions was, "How did you get here?" And I've told this story quite a lot, and people. I remember John Herity saying, "What the hell are you asking that question for? It's like ridiculous." I was like, no, it's not, because when you think what our world is, it's about the roads, it's about direction, it's about you knowing your surroundings. And I
And
always,
taking responsibility for getting to where
exactly,
you need to be.
100%, yeah. So I always took that as a real, even since I was a kid, I remember, always been interested in where you're going and everything. So yeah, that was it, So that was one of the questions. It was amazing how many of them, well, two or three of them didn't know. Oh yeah, I'm not quite sure what road it was. Mum and dad had driven them up, but they don't know that they'd come up on the M1 or whatever it was. And again, this is where I always say, like, Cav was really different. Yeah, I got the so-and-so ferry, then I got so-and-so train, got off the train, I rode my bike here or whatever it was. And you could just see people who were streetwise switched on in a different way. So I brought all that together, had a bit of a think, and we took, I think, did we take five, or only five in the first year, I think it was. And then Geraint joined to make six that year, because he was just a little bit younger than them guys and was still at school.
So is that self-sufficient then? Is that important even from a young age in being a success? Because I'm
Well,
asking because when I interviewed Judy Murray for the first series, and she talked about always making her boys carry their tennis kit, for example, and making them take responsibility for things. Is that important from a young age?
I think so. Yeah, and you can, there's a certain amount that they've already got. And you perhaps can't get that into them, But I mean now if you go around British cycling now, all the riders have their own chain rings and I can't remember what we called it in the end, like a gear bag basically. And I changed all that because when I first came back to the UK and started working with Simon Jones, I was looking at the senior guys, and they would walk into the track for a 2 o'clock in the afternoon session. and the bikes would all be lined up. Mm-hmm. And Ernie, one of the mechanics who's still there, a great mechanic, all the bikes would already be there. So Jonesy would have told them what gear they're riding. Mechanics have everything, wheels pumped up. All the lads just had to come in, sit down, listen to Jonesy, get on the bike, off they go. Came in the next day for an under-23 session, same for the under-23s, yet not one of them had won anything. And I just thought, wow, you know, this is unbelievable. This has to change. So I changed all of that across the board, you know, and gave, and that's then when I forced it into the junior program. Because I sort of wrote the junior program sort of with the under-23, so it all linked in together. So basically it was, give them a bike. Well, actually, give them two frames, a low-pro frame and a normal upright track bike, pair of wheels, normal spokes, tyres, nothing posh at all. Get chain rings, sprockets, a sprocket remover, a spanner and an Allen key. Look after them. Don't lose them. You've got the responsibility for this. Gave them a locker key. And that was it. That was their basic track kit for the year, you know. And they were self-sufficient. So I told them what okay, you're starting out on 50-15 tomorrow, and they'd have to come in and get all the bikes ready and set everything up. And I even did, I started what I called coach-led racing weekends. I think I ran them at first every month, once every month. And so I brought all the national under-23, national junior, and then invited two from each of the regions, so Wales, Scotland, and then the English regions in. So we had about 25 kids. And the parents had come along. And I even used to say to the parents, leave this to me, you go upstairs and enjoy the racing. And then I used to give the parents time afterwards to explain or to ask any questions, but I didn't want the parents down there with me. Took that from the football, where they had, like, the Man United have like a viewing gallery, parent gallery or something they call it, where the parents, you know, if they don't want them to touch side, they want them out the way because they get too involved, or, you know.
And I guess there's a conflict of authority in some way, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, you know, and I think then weekend, they were massive, they were huge changes to how we did everything at British Cycling. And yeah, that was a big shift forward in terms of all this cohort, you know, most of them went through all that, about learning how to race, about your teammates, about tactics, vision on, you know, just general vision on the bike. And we just worked on everything. Every race was filmed. We watched every single race back. It was really good. I mean, some of the lads say it was the best weekends they ever had, you know. They really enjoyed them, yeah.
So it sounds like you were a real life student of lots of different successful sporting programmes. Where did that interest come from? What made you decide to have a look at the best programmes in the world and try to pick and choose bits and adapt them?
I think when I remember when I was a kid racing, you know, never really, I look back now, it's just like, wow, why didn't I have bigger ambitions, you know? Why didn't I want to go anywhere else or whatever? And I think when I did start travelling, I was sort of 16 when I first started travelling, and I haven't stopped since. But we were always one of them lesser nations, you know. And I remember being in Belgium once and getting spat at by some of the guys, as if it was like, well, what are you lot doing here, you know? And certainly when I went to my first World Championships in Moscow there, we felt really sort of like, wow, we don't belong here. Yet then all the way through, as you know, through my own cycling, I just thought, well, you know, why not? Why can't we be better? You know, so I just believed that we were better than what we had. But I just always felt like there was never really a vehicle to take you there. So that was it, really. Just, you know, that I thought, I didn't know, I didn't have a clue if I would be able to do it. I remember saying to Jane once, I just got the job.
Jane, your wife.
Yeah. And just saying, I've got to make this work because I don't have anything else. You know, there's nothing else to go at. So I've got to make this work. So I'm going to put some time in. Jane was at university at the time, and we were living in Mosley, east of Manchester. And I just said, I've got to make this work. So I just put everything into it, put my whole life into it, really.
And you really did, because you're talking about when it all started in Manchester, but as I said, you then went with all the guys to Tuscany. You left your then girlfriend, now wife.
We got married when, so I was living in Italy. Jane had moved to Holland to work. We got married while we were, you know, we met in down in Devon where Jane grew up and got married. Then we both went back a week later. Jane went back to Holland, I went back to Italy, and we just got married. So, I mean, we put everything into it. I sort of get frustrated a little bit now because I don't, People, a lot of people at the time, a few people said to me, "What the hell are you doing? You're setting us up to fail as other coaches." That's what I did get. Somebody said that to me.
Who would have said that?
Well, other coaches. All the coaches I was working with who felt, you know, that their lives were different, that they couldn't commit like I was committing. But I knew that.
And were resentful of that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't like it was where it was now type, you know, like them not to have been really successful. But just like, I think, you know, like now I couldn't do what I did. Now I've got my own kids and it would be really, really tough to do that sort of life. But, you know, there's plenty of people out there who, well, I did, so I don't see why other people can't. And them young kids need people with them all the time. And I thought this is what I need to do. I'm just going to go for this. They're going to, you know, they're going to have me next to them all the time. So I get a little bit miffed when people sort of say things, oh, it was all right for you at the time or whatever. I was like, well, no, it's no different to anybody else. You know, just get stuck in, isn't it? And do a job, you know. But I never saw it as a job, was it? You know, it's your life. So
you did live for them, essentially. I mean, you were their big brother, their father, their coach, their boss, everything all rolled into one, really, weren't you?
Well, do you know, Steve Peters said that to me once. So, you know...
Steve Peters, the psychiatrist, who did a lot of work with British Cycling. We spoke to him for the podcast.
Yeah, and a huge influence on the whole programme, certainly on myself personally. And I think I went through a period where I wanted to learn from Steve. I was really interested in his background and what he did and how he, you know, I could just see how he was talking to people. I thought I really connect with that. So I invested, and I was fortunate enough. Steve was like, yeah, let's, you know, I went to see him. I would say on average every couple of weeks about sort of problem. Right, I've got this problem with this rider. How do I turn them around? Or, you know, anything really. It could be somebody you're working with and you want to get better at working with them. How do I do it? And sometimes I'd bring the riders in with me. And we'd say, right, how are we going to work better? What do we need to do? And so it was all really, really good. But Steve, in the very early stages, when I started the academy, he said, you've got to accept, are you going to be their dad, brother, friend, coach? And he looked at me and said, do you accept that?
Being all together.
Yeah, and he paused, and Steve does this, and it's like chilling. He pauses and just looks at you in the eye. And he doesn't say anything for like until you talk. He doesn't actually say a word till you talk. And I said, yeah, I think I am, you know. And I think he sort of said, well, I'm pleased you said yes, you know. So he said, right, you're ready for this, you know. So I've never forgot that, actually, that it's like, yeah, you know, you've got to be that person for them, haven't you? And I think each and every single one of them. So for instance, like Gavin G, I'm a totally different person to them.
So in what way?
Well, I think for Mark, you know, I perhaps was more, you know, a little bit more of a parental sort of guidance through life in a way, you know.
And you're talking in the past tense, but you're still incredibly close.
I think even now, you know, he perhaps still rings for advice or whatever, you know. And I mean, all them lads, even if I don't work with them anymore or don't coach them, I you get that sort of, you just want to see people succeed, don't you? And if you've helped them like that, it's like, you know, you can ring anytime sort of thing, you know. Well, I tell them all they can, it doesn't matter. But, you know, where Gawain, as an example, is a bit more sort of set in his way of, he knows what he wanted to do. You know, he's not so emotional with the performance. He can sort of, you know, Mark's right in it at the moment. You know, I think you can see that in interviews. You know, he blurts it out. He perhaps regrets some stuff afterwards or whatever, but he's really in the moment, you know. Gawain's a little bit more calculated with it, I feel, and he's not so needing on certain people. You know, he's quite happy to move to other people and just get on with what he does. So it's a different sort of approach, you know. Where so for Mark, it would be more, you know, it's more of a life coach, because physically on the bike, I hardly ever talk to Mark about the bike early doors. I think I even said to him early on, I'm not interested in your cycling. I'm going to work on these things with you, which were all off-bike stuff.
So like what? Can you tell us what?
Well, one of the first things, when I first met Mark, I said, right, tell me what's happened this last year. Well, I went to the national championships at Manchester and I got going and my sprocket unwound. I went to this race and I forgot my shoes. I went to that race and my rear mech dropped to pieces. I went to this one and I forgot my shorts. And It was constant, and so okay. So if your rear mech didn't drop to bits, your sprocket didn't, you didn't feel. Do you think you would have? Well, yeah, of course I would have won. It was that arrogant still, you know. Well, of course I would have won. So I said, so if we leave all that and we concentrate on this organization, do you think that would work? And he was like, yeah, I think it would work. So it was his, you know. He owned that then, didn't he? So I said, right, okay. Just do the cycling that we give you. I'm not going to ask you if you fail or you don't at that. It doesn't matter. Let's work on your organizational skills, you know. And then one of the first races we went to, we were driving, it was in North Wales. And I remember I was driving, and him and Bramier were in the back.
This is Matt
Matt
Bramier, who's
Bramier,
now British cycling
who's
coach.
now doing my job now, actually. He was in the back, and they're always, you know, giving it a bit of this. And you're having to listen to him, you're thinking, well, are they having a dig at me or not? But anyway, all of a sudden I saw Mark, he just like looked at me in the mirror. I could see his face. I left him a little while. I thought he's forgotten something. I just knew he's forgotten something. I'm not going to say anything until he tells me. And the further we get to the rules of the race, the less chance he's going to have of me turning around. So it's up to him. He needs to tell me. I'm not going to ask him. So I sat there and I was quite frustrated because I thought I'm
Is
going to
that a re
wait.
was that a really hard to bite your tongue?
Oh
I just want to pick an item out of
yeah. But it's about them, isn't it?
you.
You know, it's about making them go, well, sorry. But anyway, he did eventually go, well, I think I've forgotten my shoes. And I went, I looked at him, I was like, you're having a laugh, aren't you? And he's in the back delving around and he sits down and I saw him like sit down and he went, oh, I forgot my shoes. And I was like, oh, well, what are you going to do now? And he was like, proper didn't know what to do. And I think he was a bit scared because he thought I was going to rip into him, you know. I just said, well, what do you think you can do? He said, well, we could go back. I said, we can't because we'll be late. Okay, I could just not race or something, you know, he's going through. And then I said, well, what about if you know somebody local? Maybe some. Oh. So straight away, him and Matt got on the phone and he managed to get a pair of shoes. And I think he won the stage race overall. It was the first stage and he won overall. And the first day he rode on somebody else's shoes. So, you know, we kept working on things like that. And I say now he's a bit OTT with it, you know, a bit obsessive with things, but maybe I taught him that.
Coming up in the next episode of When Orla Met Rod Ellingworth.
I think the Grand Tours are different because, you know, they're over 3 weeks. So, for instance, like when Bradley won, it was like, oh, relief. And I was so Olympic focused, I didn't really take on his win. I think that, you know, a lot of people get Chris Froome wrong. They don't really know him as a person. They think he's a robot. They think, you know, he's not at all. He's a hard-working human being who loves doing what he does, and you know, he's found a connection with a team that works for him.
That's in the next episode of When Orla Met, available to download right now. A huge thank you to Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode. And a huge thank you to you as well for listening. If you have any thoughts on what you've heard, then do give me a follow and drop me a line on Twitter or Instagram at When Orla Met. And if you missed any of the chats with Dr. Steve Peters, who Rod talks about being influential in his work, or with Mark Cavendish or Geraint Thomas, then you can still have a listen and you can subscribe as well to not miss any of the chats still to come. Just go to your usual podcast platform and find me there, When Orla Met.